been a very hot weekend. 93 on Saturday, heat index near 100. 96 on Sunday, heat index near 101. This morning, though, not bad. 71 degrees were seen in Kenosha. Wind from the south at 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one, a look at Robin Williams, his brilliant career, his troubled personal life. And in parts two and three, two different books about fatherhood. Stay with us. When one hears the name Robin, you might be referring to any number of different people. But of course, in this particular instance, we're talking about Robin Williams, a meteoric talent, so brilliant in so many ways, brilliant and yet in other ways kind of a maddening individual who did not always know exactly what to do with his gifts. And he was, in a sense, almost an exhausting person to take in. The genius of Robin Williams, absolutely towering. What was behind the genius? David Itzkoff is a culture reporter for the New York Times, and he has written a meticulously researched biography called simply Robin that explores this man and all that he did through his career, a career, of course, cut short by illness and ultimately his tragic suicide in the summer of 2014. David Itzkoff is also responsible for a very poignant memoir called Cocaine's Son. Again, this latest book is titled Robin. David Itzkoff, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I appreciate that.
I'm very impressed by the book, and I'm very mindful of what a steep challenge it had to be to try to make sense of somebody like Robin Williams. Going into this project, did you fully understand just how challenging a book this would be to write?
No, I don't think so, which is, maybe for the best. Maybe I would not have attempted it if I really knew what was awaiting me. I had certainly some experience in the sense that I had written about Robin for the New York Times on a few occasions and had spent time with him and even traveled on the road with him for a few days in what would end up being his last comedy tour. So I got to know him a little bit and some of the important people in his world, even his son Zach, who became very important for the book. But even in getting to see a little bit behind the curtain in those instances, there was still so much more waiting to be discovered. And I think, as his work suggested, and as we saw at the end of his life, there was just so much more about him, and a lot that I think he kind of kept concealed or kept at a distance from people.
As you say, at some point in the book, everyone got a piece of him, and a fortunate few got quite a lot of him, but no one got all of him. And there, in a nutshell, also, in a sense, summarizes the challenge confronting you. I'm intrigued by the fact that you were clearly a great fan of Robin Williams and of his genius, and yet this book is not a Valentine, nor is it a hatchet job.
I appreciate that.
It just feels like you have really achieved quite an impressive balance in terms of telling us the full story of Robin Williams, to whatever extent we can know that full story, warts and all. How conscious were you through the course of writing this book, and especially in the process of finishing the book, in terms of achieving some kind of balanced portrait of who he was?
Well, I think that comes a little bit from my, you know, training and years at the New York Times, and I think, you know, trying to be balanced and fair in how we write about people, whatever their sort of stature or walk of life. And I think it also has to do a lot with how Robin conducted himself and how he spoke about himself. From my interviews with him, other journalists, and certainly in his own stand-up in that last tour, he was dealing with a lot of complicated things in his life. Just a couple years prior, he had relapsed into alcoholism and had been to rehab to get himself sober, and then he went through a very painful divorce with his second wife, who was really integral to his life and career. And then even trying to start that tour for the first time, it had to be halted pretty early on because he was having heart problems and then had to have valve replacement surgery and recover from that before the tour could resume. So with all those things in the background, I was a little bit, you know, certainly spending time with him, concerned about, well, how do I ask him about these things? Is he even going to want to talk about them? And really, to my surprise, he was extremely open and kind of relentlessly candid and confessional in how he spoke to me and how he performed, really wanting people to know about all these things that he'd experienced and, you know, some of the really troubling things that he had been through, things that he felt he did to other people while he was drunk, the importance of getting sober. And I think when somebody is that open about themselves and putting themselves out there that way, you're not really, you know, you're not exposing anything. You're not sort of, you know, depicting them in a way that they themselves did not want to be depicted or wanted people to know that they were that way. So that, I think, made it easier in a sense. It wasn't upending necessarily people's notions of who Robin was.
Hmm. You obviously spoke to Robin Williams on a number of different occasions, and for the purposes of this book, you spoke to what appears to be a dizzying array of persons who were a part of his life in one way or another. I mean, I very quickly lost count after a while. Do you have any sense of just how many different people you were able to speak to about Robin Williams?
You know, we really tried to just cast the net as wide as we could. So that includes, as I mentioned, you know, his son, his first wife, his surviving half-brother, the widow of his deceased half-brother, but people who were friendly with him going all the way back to, you know, his earliest schools that he attended, and certainly the people that were you know, professionally acquainted with him and friendly with him all through his life. So certainly folks like Billy Crystal and you know, David Letterman, who you know, knew him from very early on, and Jay Leno, who was there at the start of his you know, stand-up comedy career, you know, directors of all of his films, and actors like Pam Dauber, who of course was his co-star in Mork and Mindy and also remained a great friend of his. You just try to talk to as many people as you can, and you know, I spent probably, I don't know, a year to a year and a half just reporting and doing interviews and trying to find people before I even sat down to really write anything. And you know, of course, you continue to talk to people even as you're writing. So in the course of that, hopefully we got a good you know, cross-section of the people that were part of his life.
We're speaking with Dave Itzkoff about his brand-new biography of Robin Williams, titled simply Robin. Obviously, even at the end of this sprawling biography, we do not come away with any sort of magic answer to how did Robin Williams become Robin Williams.
Sure.
There just is no way to fully solve that mystery. It is intriguing to look back at his childhood, which was not certainly an intensely unhappy childhood. I mean, we sometimes hear about comedy springing out of tragedy or out of sorrow. But it was certainly a lonely childhood in many respects.
Yeah,
Talk for a moment about in what ways it was an often lonely and kind of isolated childhood for him, and what you think that has to do with what Robin Williams went on to do.
Sure, sure. I mean, I think you also make a really good point that, as you say, that we think about, you know, personality, certainly like someone like Richard Pryor or more contemporarily, you know, Tracy Morgan. I mean, people who really did have hard childhoods and hard upbringings and that forge them into comedians, and that was not Robin's upbringing in that sense, that he came from a lot of wealth, and that his father was a Ford executive, and moving the family between very upscale parts of Illinois and Michigan. I mean, living in literal mansions with 30 or 40 rooms. But also, his father, as I mentioned, traveled a lot for his work. He was also a World War II veteran and kind of a very upright man, and also a little bit distant from Robin in that way. His mother was kind of descended from southern aristocracy, and a great-grandfather who had been a governor and a senator for the state of Mississippi. She was very active in her own social life and social functions, and also had a great sense of humor that Robin clearly inherited. But for both of those parents, I think, felt absent from his life at times. And even though he had friends in every school that he attended and was popular, he did feel alone often and felt isolated. And certainly by the time he was living in Bloomfield Hills in Michigan, just outside of Detroit, growing up in this kind of massive mansion that was way more space than the family needed, he basically had the attic all to himself, and that's where he would go to play with his toy soldiers and just stage these massive battles and try to give the toys their own voices and make them each characters. And that became a kind of laboratory for him to develop a lot of the tools that would really serve him well as a comedian.
It's so interesting to think about somebody like Robin Williams going to a place like Juilliard. Describe for us just what kind of a match that was. Was it the mismatch that we sort of imagine it to be?
Yes and no. Robin had actually trained quite a bit as an actor even before he got to Juilliard, that he had attended two previous colleges and done a lot of stage work at that point and been in a lot of local Bay Area productions. If you were living in Marin County in 1971, you could have seen him play Fagin in Oliver. So certainly, by the time he got to Juilliard, it was very early in the sort of existence of their school of drama, and John Houseman was still running it. And they at first had brought Robin in as an advanced student, meaning that he could graduate in just 2 years because he had all this experience and they felt a lot of talent. But they also felt that he lacked a lot of discipline, and after that first year, they took him out of that advanced program and put him in the normal 4-year track. So already they're sort of feeling like he is not, a perfect fit for them. And then after his third year, sort of by mutual decision, they wanted to cut him, and he wanted to withdraw. They again felt he was talented. But I think the regimen of it and that real sort of, again, the classical background of it, some aspects of it agreed with him, and in other ways he just really wanted to bust out beyond those boundaries. And the school was all too willing to let him go at that time.
Well, bust out, of course, he eventually did.
Yeah.
Describe to our listeners what you recount in the book's prologue.
Well, I talk about one of the very first times that a mass audience probably would have been able to see him perform comedy on television, and that was a part of a TV special called The Great American Laugh-Off. And Robin just performs a kind of 5-minute set in that show, and it's a whole panoply of different characters. So he comes on pretending to be a Russian stand-up comedian and talking with a Russian accent, and he'll turn into Jacques Cousteau, or he'll turn into Superman on drugs, who's kind of flying backwards and upside down. And again, it's very, in some ways, it's already a kind of fully formed Robin Williams performance. What's so interesting is that in that span of time, you never really see Robin speak in his own voice or just perform as himself. And so if that was your first exposure to Robin, you would not have had any sense of who the real person behind all those characters was. And I thought that said a lot about him in terms of somebody who could move so quickly and throw all these kinds of illusions in front of you, but in a way was also trying to keep you distracted and not think about who the person behind all of it was.
I suppose that's why you, in fact, call him an illusionist more than impressionist or any other number of terms that one might try to use to describe what they experienced on that stage that night.
Sure, particularly in that era, I think, comedy, stand-up comedy tended to fall into very kind of specific categories of this was the kind of thing that you did, and it was evolving beyond just the kind of traditional, man in a suit and tie telling you a kind of linear narrative monologue, and Robin was a huge pioneer of that, of it becoming a much more sort of, seat of the pants experience, and that there didn't have to be a kind of a logic or a through line. It could just be sort of whatever popped into his head, and then the moment he got bored with a bit, that he could just jump to the next thing, and there didn't have to be any explanation of why.
You spend a few pages of your book talking about the sitcom Mork and Mindy, which I think began
in 1978.
Of course, that's what really put him on the map for most Americans for the first time. One of the things I wanted to be sure to ask you about is how difficult was it for you to write about some of his behavior on that set, particularly with co-star Pam Dauber, with whom you spoke? Behavior that I think probably would be received very differently today in this kind of Me Too era in which we live.
Pam certainly talked about just the experience of working with him, and that, in a lot of ways he would try to, get a rise out of her, so to speak, by behaving in, I think, a way that we can clearly see as kind of, sexual, that he would, expose himself to her, or he would grope her, or, tell her, dirty jokes. And she's very forgiving of that. She certainly regarded him almost as a kind of, a brother, that they were both about the same age when they were working on the show. They had both grown up in different parts of Michigan, so they felt like they had similar upbringings. But I think we do understand now that part of what was going on, I think, even if it wasn't Robin's intention to try to, come on to her or make an advance, I think there certainly is a power dynamic that was at play there, that this is Robin starting to understand on some level that his show is a success, he is the star of the show, and that gives him, or he certainly takes license to behave in a way and do things to her that he can get away with, and that she certainly couldn't tell him, don't do that to me, because that would be, somehow upsetting the power dynamic. And again, even though she is forgiving of it, I think it's certainly not an appropriate way for anybody to behave, and it certainly was not. It's not the kind of thing that is, would be tolerated today. You're absolutely right.
He, of course, achieved stupendous fame on the stand-up stage, and also some success in film. But his film career, as we read in your book, was a much rockier thing. That is a very checkered experience. And I wonder if, after studying him and his career so thoroughly, if you have an explanation for why his film career was as uneven as it was.
Well, it's just a confluence of a lot of things. Even very talented people can find it hard to find the exact right vehicle for themselves. In some ways, Mork, even though that was really the first character he was known for, that was sort of perfect for him because it gave him the freedom to improvise and to be so many other characters within a character. You'd never have that kind of latitude again. And people not, including himself, not knowing, well, is it best to continue in comedic roles, best to do dramatic roles? He had the passion and the appetite for all of it. And certainly right up until Good Morning Vietnam, which didn't come out until the end of 1987, start of 88, all the movies in between, some were critically successful. None was a huge commercial success, and even to the point where both the industry and Robin himself are starting to think, well, maybe Robin is not a leading man. Maybe this isn't something that he was meant to do. Maybe he's a sort of a second banana at best. And once Good Morning Vietnam was a success, and that was a role that was really shaped for him and developed specifically for him, that's what put him over the top.
Someone like him with such a huge talent, how difficult was him to be a colleague? I mean, because one of the points of being a good colleague when you're working on a film or working on a TV program or whatever is to help enhance and draw out the talent of others. To what extent could he even be aware of the talent of others in the room?
Well, I think it's something that it took him a little while to kind of develop those skills and to warm up to. That certainly on the first couple of movies that he made, specifically Popeye, which he made with Robert Altman, and then The World According to Garp, which was directed by George Roy Hill. I mean, those are both really seasoned directors. They're both guys who definitely did not take any guff on their sets, and neither one of them were really at first open to the idea of Robin improvising at all, which is of course one of his trademarks and something that he wanted to be able to do. So there was certainly conflict with Altman and with Hill on the set of Garp. The first few days, if Robin went off script at all, Hill would just call cut for the day. So very quickly, he's trying to teach Robin, you know, this is my set and not yours. I think later on, as directors came to, the ones that could work best with him, certainly people like Barry Levinson, who worked with him on Good Morning Vietnam, or Terry Gilliam, who made The Fisher King with him, they sort of understood, let Robin have a few takes for himself. Give him a couple takes where he plays the script as written, then let him sort of go off book and do his wild improvisations, maybe have a few takes that are come out somewhere in the middle. And somewhere in the editing room, you will find the take that you need. And that was really the best way to work with him.
Do you have time for two more quick questions?
Oh, I'm happy to.
Great. Let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Dave Itzkoff from The New York Times and the author of a brand new and sprawling biography of Robin Williams, titled simply Robin. One of the things I wanted to be sure to ask you about, although we'll leave it to our listeners to explore your book and explore some of these issues in greater length, are the demons that held Robin Williams back, that deprived him of the happiness and joy that that he wanted so much. I mean, not that he was never happy or never joyous, but there were these demons, of course, that really color the picture in some really ultimately tragic ways. Of all of those demons that were part of his life, did you come away with a sense of one being especially harmful to him?
Well, I think, it's hard to, to sort of quantify them, but certainly he had a kind of insecurity about himself throughout his life and career. For all the success that he achieved and for as much as he was beloved by people, I don't think he ever fully accepted that, that he really sort of possessed the talent that a lot of people saw in him, even near the end of his life. There's a story that his half-brother tells me where they went out to eat at a restaurant, and the waiter goes away, and Robin is sort of pointing out, what's the difference between me and that waiter? Robin caught a few lucky breaks, but otherwise there's really nothing, there's no reason why I should have had the life that I did, and the waiter is doing what he does. And that's it's a really bittersweet, almost sad way to think about him, as never, totally understanding or accepting that he was as good as everybody saw him. It's a really sort of sad thing to contemplate.
And do you feel like that was, in a sense, the source of these other demons? I mean, the abuses of himself in which he engaged at so many points in time, fueled by that?
Yeah, it's hard to know. I'm the child of a recovered drug addict, and it's even when somebody is who's that close to you has those kinds of problems, it's not easy to sort of pin down, well, this is what made them do it, or was it something that they chose? Was it inevitable? Was it sort of inbred in them? And it's just so hard to know. But certainly, I think when you combine that with just the kind of exceptional fame that he enjoyed, the kind of stage that he was put on, and the continuous scrutiny that he was very much aware of. I mean, that's a very very challenging way to have to live your life, for sure.
At one point, you say in the book, the real Robin was a modest, almost inconspicuous man. Can you explain what is behind those intriguing words that are so at odds with how we typically think of Robin Williams?
Yeah, well, I think he was, there was certainly a part of him that was very gentle and soft-spoken and private and bookish in that way. And I mean, that was as much a part of him and as much the true him as the kind of person that you saw on stage. He was not that guy 24/7. I mean, he could be relentless at times, but he wasn't always like that. And that was part of the act.
Well, we can learn much more about Robin Williams and his spectacular career and intriguing persona in your marvelous book titled Robin, published by Henry Holt and Company. The author, Dave Itzkoff. Dave Itzkoff, thank you so much for making time for this conversation.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you for giving the world such a fascinating book.
Thank you very much, and I really enjoyed the chat today. Thank you.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. With Father's Day coming up on Sunday, I thought it would be interesting to offer up a couple of different interviews related to fatherhood. And we have one brand new interview that we'll share with you right now. And following that will be an interview that comes out of the Morning Show archives, featuring the great Tim Russert. Here we go with part two of today's morning show. And just ahead of Father's Day, I'm very, very excited to be able to speak with renowned film director and screenwriter Eduardo Ponti, who also happens to be the son of Sofia Loren and Carlo Ponti. And Eduardo Ponti has just created a beautiful book called Letters from a Young Father. It is a collection of 40 poems that are letters that he wrote during his wife's pregnancy. And these beautiful poems and letters touch on all kinds of different facets of the experience of impending fatherhood and what it is like to wait for this immeasurable joy and some of the fears that are also sometimes part of that experience as well. It's a remarkable book published by Zeno Books, and Eduardo Ponti is with us for a few minutes to talk about this experience and the book. Eduardo Ponti, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you for having me, Greg.
I really loved the book a lot. I didn't know what to expect until I began reading it, and I was truly impressed. As you began this process, were you thinking all along as you were writing these poems that these were going to add up to a book someday, or was it a more spontaneous idea?
Yes, I had no idea. You know, ever since I can remember, I write poetry. Poetry is my way of making sense of all the swirling things that I have inside. And so when, you know, as we all know, you know, becoming a father is a very harrowing experience. So there were a lot of emotions swirling inside of me. And so I took pen to paper, and one day I sat down and I started writing a letter to my child. And that letter was in the form of a poem. And every week I sat down and I wrote another letter to my child. And before I knew it, I had 40 of them for the 40 weeks of my wife's pregnancy.
Did you share these poems with her through the course of the pregnancy, or was this something that, in a sense, you were doing in more private fashion, really for yourself?
Yes, it was something more in private fashion for myself, but I did share with her some in the second half of the pregnancy. So it wasn't something that I immediately did, but slowly as this manuscript was, in a sense, taking shape, then I started sharing more with my wife.
Mm. I would love us to touch on several of the poems that are particularly intriguing, and I think the most intriguing of the poems is the one you write in week four, which begins with these words: "For you to dawn, why does she need to dusk? For you to blossom, why does she need to wither? Your mother has left herself as abruptly as a sharp right. Silence is her new language, sleep her new dance. She tries to hide her tears, but I feel them in the absence of her touch. The only certainty is the fullness of her doubts, the only truth that she knows nothing more. She tries to find a way back, but only sinks deeper. How much of her has to die to pay for the beginnings of you? How much of our love do we have to give up to feed your heart?" You're touching on an experience of pregnancy that doesn't get written about all that much. Did anything in particular prompt you to write this particular poem? What was going on in your wife's pregnancy at this point in time?
Well, you know, it's very simply put, it's hormones. It's the revolution that happens in a woman's body when all of the organs are at the service of a new life. And it's a very complicated, very difficult time for women, understandably so. And I think many women go through these moments early on in the pregnancy of doubts, of really not understanding what's happening to themselves and to their bodies. And it's a especially difficult thing to be a man standing by your woman going through this, because there's very little that you can do other than be there for them. And it does leave you in a powerless position, because you're not going through exactly what they're going through, but you're experiencing it in a very different way.
Hmm. I appreciate that the poems collectively include not only what we would think of as the what sometimes feels like some kind of an ethereal world of poetry, but also there's plenty of nitty-gritty here as well. For instance, in the poem you write in week seven, which is the first time you and your wife saw your new baby on an ultrasound. Just talk for a moment about that experience.
Well, it's the first time that you truly meet your child. And it's something quite amazing, because you meet your child before he or she meets you. And so it's a little bit like looking at life through a keyhole. You're not really meant to, but once you look through the keyhole, you're mesmerized by what you see, by these limbs slowly growing, by that heart beating so quickly. And that's when you're truly struck by the enormity of the gift, the enormity, the immensity of the experience, and the overwhelming responsibility of it all.
Hmm. There is at least one poem that talks about some test that is done at one point during the pregnancy just to make sure that everything is okay. Describe what that moment was, and about writing a poem about it.
Well, my wife was not in her 20s when she had her first child. She was in her 30s. So, as any responsible parent, when a woman is in her 30s, you know, the doctor does prescribe an amniocentesis test to make sure that everything is okay. And the test was it's really harrowing, because it's basically they have to extract a certain amount of fluid from the amniotic sac in order to see whether the child is healthy, and that of course is a very delicate procedure that countless women go through, but nonetheless it's very harrowing.
Right, and as you write in here, the risk is a miscarriage. The reward, the assurance you are not broken. But of course, at the outset, you have no idea whether or not that is going to be the verdict of this test.
That's right. That's right. And we go through these things because we want the best for our children.
Of course. I also want to ask you about what's maybe my single favorite poem among all of these, which is from week 10. And the subtitle of this particular poem is Stuck in Traffic. But this is probably the poem of all of these that would seem to have the least to do, directly at least, with the pregnancy or with fatherhood. It's just such a beautiful reflection of life. It is, never give to receive, or kiss to be kissed, never hold to be held, or love to be loved. Your light does not live in the light of others, but in the peace of your palm when you give just to give. It lives on the lip of your lips when you kiss just to kiss, on the tip of your touch when you hold just to hold, in the abandon of your heart when you love just to love. And if you follow this with the simplicity only wisdom may bring, then all the light you spread will be returned. What prompted you to write this? And how does this fit into the story of this journey to fatherhood?
Yeah, you know, this is this poem is a poem. It falls under the category of life lessons. I think that when you are waiting for your child to be born, you meditate on your own life and on what matters to you and what values you want to share with your child. And we live in such an emotionally greedy and egocentric society that I think it's important to impart the opposite of that to your child. In other words, that in order to receive, you got to give. In order to be loved, you got to love. And those are the secrets to happiness. The more you give, the more you share, the happier you will be.
It's a lovely, lovely thought, and this whole book is lovely indeed. And I encourage anybody interested to seek it out. Again, it's called Letters from a Young Father. It is 40 poems altogether, published by Zeno Books, and the author, Eduardo Ponti. Eduardo Ponti, my congratulations to you. What a lovely book, and thank you for sharing it with the world, and thank you for being part of today's morning show.
Well, thank you so much. And since it's Father's Day right around the corner, I hope that this will make for a beautiful gift for people.
And the time is 8:47 on the Friday morning show here on WGTT. And to finish out today's program, we're digging deep into the archives for one of actually two different conversations I was privileged to record with Tim Russert. For many years, the host of NBC's Meet the Press, for many years, Washington bureau chief for NBC News, and the author of a number of different books. This particular interview is around a book of his recorded, published more than a decade ago, called Wisdom of Our Fathers, Lessons and Letters from Daughters and Sons, published by Random House. Tim Russert died 10 years ago, earlier this week. One of the things, Mr. Russert, that I find especially striking about your book is that after these various accounts which came to you from ordinary people, often we'll see a name, a comma, and then a simple single word, and often that single word is pharmacist or machinist. I mean, this is a book which gathers together stories from people who are not famous, ordinary working people who otherwise would never find their stories in a book. I wonder how much you thought about that as you put this together.
Well, it reflects reality. After I wrote Big Russ and Me, about my dad who quit school in the 10th grade and the fight in World War II, He was terribly injured when his B-24 Liberator went down. He spent 6 months in a military hospital and then came back and started a second mission with my mom to raise and educate his four kids. And he did it by working two full-time jobs as a garbage man and a truck driver. He didn't ask for anything and gave everything. And as I went around the country, and in the following months, I received 60,000 letters and emails from sons and daughters who perceived the book as an invitation to talk about their dad. And they were from all walks of life. And they wanted to say that it was not an expensive vacation or a material gift that they remember most about their dad. It was the small moment, the tender touch, those small moments that made the big difference. And they are regular guys. These are not superheroes. They're people who get up every morning and do their best. And I read the letters, and it was a very emotional experience for me. I read them all myself. It took me a year and a half. But I wanted to put them together in a book which a son and daughter could give their dad and say, hey, Dad, read about these other dads. They're a lot like you.
Mm.
Thank you.
You know, one thing that's interesting is for as ordinary as these fathers are by and large, though they do great things in the way that they ended up being fathers and parenting, in many cases, the children who write about their fathers are really doing an exceptionally fine job of it. Did you edit these stories very much, or did they come to you so beautifully eloquent?
They were crafted by the children, by the sons and daughters. You know, I would make some suggestions or small edits, but nothing significant. I was overwhelmed by the quality. And I say this as a man and with three sisters. The letters from the daughters were so powerful, so emotional. I find I and a lot of my buddies, we kind of back into these kind of discussions. You know, let me tell you about my dad, and not the daughters. They are front and center. I am daddy's girl. The only daddy could call me by this pet name. My daddy treated me like a princess. And you just read this and marvel at it, how this bond between a father and a daughter is so very special.
I want you to tell our listeners the story you mentioned in the introduction of a certain doctor who I believe comes to one of your book signings for that first book you wrote about you and your own father. What a powerful moment that was for you.
Dr. Alfred Tanz, and I was sitting at the table signing books, and as is the custom when there's a line, they take a little sticky postum and put it on the book so you're signing looking down, and it said Alfred Tanz, and I started signing the book to Alfred Tanz, best always, Tim Russert. And I said, Alfred Tanz, that sounds, and I looked up, and there was this little man. It was Dr. Tanz. He said to me, do you remember me? I'm the man who brought your son Luke into the world. And he had delivered our son. He seemed so much smaller out of his scrubs. When he was in his scrubs holding my baby boy, he was the biggest man in the history of my life. But he was also the first man to call me Dad. He said, congratulations, Dad. You have a baby boy. And I just got up and I hugged him and hugged him and hugged him. It was so emotional to me. I had not seen him since the birth of my son some 20 years ago. And it was in terms of coming full circle, the man who brought my son into the world now standing before me as I signed a book about fathers and sons and daughters.
Hmm. We're speaking with Tim Russert about his new book called Wisdom of Our Fathers, Lessons and Letters from Daughters and Sons. We think of one of the abiding themes in your book, and that is of the man who does not easily express emotion or perhaps affection. As you've talked now with so many children from across the country over the course of several different generations, do you find that that is changing to a great extent, or do you think most fathers still have some trouble with that compared to the typical mother, for instance?
I think it's changed dramatically. I mean, moms are our nurturers. They're the ones who comfort us, you know, touch our head for fevers and treat us our earaches. And certainly that was the case with my own mom. She actually used to put warm tea bags on my eyes to ease the pain. We lived near a steel plant. And my eyes used to get irritated frequently. I know it in my own life. My dad never said, I love you, until after I wrote the book. But I knew he did. I could tell by his hard work and his sacrifice. I'm much different with my own son. I say to him every day, Luke, I love you. You're always, always loved, but you're never, never entitled. I also add that because I want him to accept the same lessons that my dad taught me about hard work and accountability and respect and civility.
Hmm. You have a whole...
I think more and more daughters and sons say that they are different than their dads in that they are very expressive with words. The important thing, however, I think is it's also got to be matched with actions. I received a letter the other day saying, you know, the theme of your book is that it's better to see a sermon than it is to hear one.
Hmm.
And I think that's why the lessons our dad taught us are so powerful, because we saw them.
Hmm.
We saw the quiet eloquence of their act, and that makes a real impression.
You do acknowledge in the introduction that out of these 60,000 emails and letters that you received, there were a few that expressed something else, and that, of course, is that not all fathers are good fathers. And there are even a few fathers out there that are terrible fathers. Where do you think the lesson is in that? How do we acknowledge that truth as at the same time that we celebrate the good fathers among us?
Well, we have to. And it was not a large percentage of the letters, but I did receive some. And I wanted to be open about that because there are some monsters out there, as one daughter described her dad. They're dads who drink too much and gamble or run away from their families and don't fulfill their responsibilities. And we have to deal with it. There's also many sons and daughters wrote me about tensions or strain or estrangement from their dads. There's a whole chapter on forgiveness and reconciliation, how fathers and sons and daughters didn't speak for 5, 7, 10, 12, 15 years. And these sons and daughters talk about how they were able to put back together their relationship and how much more meaningful it is. It can be difficult. It can be challenging. But it's something worth undertaking.
Hmm.
One painful letter on this subject was from Lou Christine, who tried so hard to have a relationship with his dad, who had the same name. He would see him in a drugstore, and his dad would ignore him. His dad drove a taxi. He would look all over town looking for his dad's taxi and wave at it, honk the horn. His father would never acknowledge him. They were in a courtroom together one time, and the judge said Luke Christine, and both said here simultaneously. In the end, Luke did this. He concluded his letters by saying, I just have to say one thing, that my dad missed out on knowing a pretty good son.
Hmm.
So he just wouldn't be worn down by that. But by and large, overwhelmingly, the vast, vast majority of these sons and daughters say that they had quite a guide for their dad and are forever, forever grateful.
Well, and even those that are difficult situations sometimes talk about it humorously. I love Peter DeMattia's line.
God loves you, and I'm trying.
Right. Sometimes that's the way Father looks as well. The book, again, Wisdom of Our Fathers, Lessons and Letters from Daughters and Sons, published by Random House. Tim Russert, this is a wonderful book, and I thank you for putting it together and for talking about it today on our morning show. Best wishes to you.
And happy Father's Day to everyone. Thank you very much.
This interview with Tim Russert was recorded back in 2007. Earlier this week marked the 10th anniversary of Tim Russert's sudden and very unexpected death. We want to remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. And if you are interested in hearing past morning shows, we have a considerable archive reaching back several years, and it is found easily on our website. Go to wgtd.org And the Morning Show Archive is found right there on the front page to the right-hand side of the screen. Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back.